Welcome to Words to Live By, a podcast series hosted by the Ronald Reagan Presidential Foundation and Institute. Each week, we will share some of the wit and wisdom of Ronald Reagan. In essence, Words to Live By, made up of radio addresses and speeches he delivered from the 1960s through the 1980s. If one thinks about Ronald Reagan's signature causes, the things that come to mind are peace through strength, economic opportunity, individual liberty, and national pride. What many people have forgotten is his campaign for democracy. Yeah, a global campaign for democracy, which was launched 40 years ago on June 8, 1982. The setting for that speech? The British Parliament. And the speech came to be known as his Westminster Speech. He became the first American president to deliver an address before British Parliament and stood in a grand and regal setting speaking at the Royal Gallery of the House of Lords, with paintings of British military victories lining the walls and guards in their red beefeater uniforms standing behind him. So let's go back to what the world was like in June 1982 before we go any further. At the time, U.S. troops were part of a multinational peacekeeping force in Lebanon. Polish Solidarity leader Lech Walesa was languishing in prison as martial law continued to prevail in Poland. France agreed to buy natural gas from the Soviet Union for the next 25 years. President Reagan suggested the elimination of all nuclear missiles in Europe, in contrast to Brezhnev's two-thirds proposal. The DeLorean Motor Company went into receivership. The Dow Jones average was 1,046. And Marxist leader of Nicaragua, Daniel Ortega, suspended Nicaragua's constitution as leader of its junta. So with that historical context in mind, President Reagan asked this question.
If history teaches anything, it teaches self-delusion in the face of unpleasant facts is folly. We see around us today the marks of our terrible dilemma, predictions of doomsday, anti-nuclear demonstrations, an arms race in which the West must, for its own protection, be an unwilling participant. At the same time, we see totalitarian forces in the world who seek subversion and conflict around the globe to further their barbarous assault on the human spirit. What then is our course? Must civilization perish in a hail of fiery atoms? Must freedom wither in a quiet, deadening accommodation with totalitarian evil?
This is a question that we can relate to today as we observe the march of Russian aggression in Eastern Europe. 40 years ago in the Soviet Union, the old hardliners were still in charge, expecting America to stand down as they marched across the globe, infecting countries with communist propaganda. President Reagan joked, "This just in from Moscow, someone just broke into the Kremlin and stole next year's election results." So when President Reagan was addressing Parliament, before he launched into a campaign for democracy, he presented an evaluation of the current status quo in totalitarian countries. Briefly,
"Well, this is precisely our mission today, to preserve freedom as well as peace. It may not be easy to see, but I believe we live now at a turning point. In an ironic sense, Karl Marx was right. We are witnessing today a great revolutionary crisis, a crisis where the demands of the economic order are conflicting directly with those of the political order. But the crisis is happening not in the free, non-Marxist West, but in the home of Marxist-Leninism, the Soviet Union. It is the Soviet Union that runs against the tide of history by denying human freedom and human dignity to its citizens. It also is in deep economic difficulty. The rate of growth in the national product has been steadily declining since the 50s and is less than half of what it was then. The dimensions of this failure are astounding. A country which employs one-fifth of its population in agriculture is unable to feed its own people. Were it not for the private sector, the tiny private sector tolerated in Soviet agriculture, the country might be on the brink of famine. These private plots occupy a bare 3% of the arable land, but account for nearly one quarter of Soviet farm output and nearly one third of meat products and vegetables. over-centralized, with little or no incentives, year after year, the Soviet system pours its best resource into the making of instruments of destruction. The constant shrinkage of economic growth combined with the growth of military production is putting a heavy strain on the Soviet people. What we see here is a political structure that no longer corresponds to its economic base, a society where productive forces are hampered by political ones. The decay of the Soviet experiment should come as no surprise to us. Wherever the comparisons have been made between free and closed societies, West Germany and East Germany, Austria and Czechoslovakia, Malaysia and Vietnam, it is the democratic countries that are prosperous and responsive to the needs of their people. And one of the simple but overwhelming facts of our time is this: of all the millions of refugees we've seen in the modern world, their flight is always away from, not toward, the communist world. Today on the NATO line, our military forces face east to prevent a possible invasion. On the other side of the line, the Soviet forces also face east to prevent their people from leaving.
To intensify his rhetoric, he described recent elections and global trends where those seeking freedom did so at immense risk.
More recently, we've seen evidence of this same human impulse in one of the developing nations in Central America. For months and months, the world news media covered the fighting in El Salvador. Day after day, we were treated to stories and film slanted toward the brave freedom fighters battling oppressive government forces in behalf of the silent, suffering people of that tortured country. And then one day, those silent, suffering people were offered a chance to vote, to choose the kind of government they wanted. Suddenly, the freedom fighters in the hills were exposed for what they really are: Cuban-backed guerrillas who want power for themselves and their backers, not democracy for the people. They threatened death to any who voted and destroyed hundreds of buses and trucks to keep the people from getting to the polling places. But on election day, the people of El Salvador, an unprecedented 1.4 million of them, braved ambush and gunfire and trudged for miles to vote for freedom. They stood for hours in the hot sun, waiting for their turn to vote. Members of our Congress who went there as observers told me of a woman who was wounded by rifle fire on the way to the polls, who refused to leave the line to have her wound treated until after she had voted. A grandmother who had been told by the guerrillas she would be killed when she returned from the polls. And she told the guerrillas, "You can kill me, you can kill my family, kill my neighbors, but you can't kill us all." The real freedom fighters of El Salvador turned out to be the people of that country, the young, the old, the in-between. Strange, but my own country, there's been little, if any, news coverage of that war since the election. Around the world today, the democratic revolution is gathering new strength. In India, a critical test has been passed with the peaceful change of governing political parties. In Africa, Nigeria is moving into remarkable and unmistakable ways to build and strengthen its democratic institutions. In the Caribbean and Central America, 16 of 24 countries have freely elected governments. And in the United Nations, 8 of the 10 developing nations which have joined that body in the past 5 years are democracies. In the communist world as well, man's instinctive desire for freedom and self-determination surfaces again and again. To be sure, there are grim reminders of how brutally the police state attempts to snuff out this quest for self-rule. 1953 in East Germany, 1956 in Hungary, 1968 in Czechoslovakia, 1981 in Poland. But the struggle continues in Poland, and we know that there are even those who strive and suffer for freedom within the confines of the Soviet Union itself. How we conduct ourselves here in the Western democracies will determine whether this trend continues.
Then he moved forward. Yes, he believed in bolstering our defenses, but in this speech, he then went on the offense by advocating a campaign for democracy. After all, didn't someone say that the best defense is a good offense? So after this brief message, we'll hear more from the Westminster speech and move into the critical section about President Reagan's historic campaign for democracy.
The Ronald Reagan Presidential Foundation is the nonprofit organization created by President Reagan himself and specifically charged by him with continuing his legacy and sharing his principles: individual liberty, economic opportunity, global democracy, and national pride. We must remain vigilant and work together to share these conservative principles with younger generations. Your role is critical to move our mission forward. Thank you for your continued support. Please visit reaganfoundation.org/give. That's reaganfoundation.org/give.
Now, back to the Westminster speech of June 1982. The president announced the launch of what would later be called Project Democracy, and ultimately this formed the basis of the National Endowment for Democracy, which was a bold effort to not simply protect freedom, but advance it. So here we go. Let's listen.
No, democracy is not a fragile flower. Still, it needs cultivating. If the rest of this century is to witness the gradual growth of freedom and democratic ideals, we must take actions to assist the campaign for democracy. Some argue that we should encourage democratic change in right-wing dictatorships, but not in communist regimes. Well, to accept this preposterous notion, as some well-meaning people have, is to invite the argument that once countries achieve a nuclear capability, they should be allowed an undisturbed reign of terror over their own citizens. We reject this course. As for the Soviet view, Chairman Brezhnev repeatedly has stressed that the competition of ideas and systems must continue, and that this is entirely consistent with relaxation of tensions and peace. Well, we ask only that these systems begin by living up to their own constitutions, abiding by their own laws, and complying with the international obligations they have undertaken. We ask only for a process, a direction, a basic code of decency, not for an instant transformation. We cannot ignore the fact that even without our encouragement, there has been and will continue to be repeated explosions against repression and dictatorships. The Soviet Union itself is not immune to this reality. Any system is inherently unstable that has no peaceful means to legitimize its leaders. In such cases, the very repressiveness of the state ultimately drives people to resist it, if necessary, by force. While we must be cautious about forcing the pace of change, we must not hesitate to declare our ultimate objectives and to take concrete actions to move toward them. We must be staunch in our conviction that freedom is not the sole prerogative of a lucky few, but the inalienable and universal right of all human beings. So states the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which, among other things, guarantees free elections. The objective I propose is quite simple to state: to foster the infrastructure of democracy, the system of a free press, unions, political parties, universities, which allows a people to choose their own way, to develop their own culture, to reconcile their own differences through peaceful means.
The signature words which resonate from this speech, the campaign for democracy, represent what he, along with his trusted colleague Margaret Thatcher, believed were essential to ensure the triumph of democratic societies. Those signature words survived all the versions of the speech throughout its complete development and ultimately served as the foundation of what we now know as the Reagan Doctrine. We are fortunate here at the Reagan Library to have within our archives the assets which provide unique insight into the formation of this memorable address. We know that several researchers were involved, whose early notes show references to the writings of Madison, Jefferson, Lincoln, Churchill, Thatcher, Eisenhower and Truman. Excerpts from works like Chesterton, Emerson, Disraeli, Burke, Gladstone, C.S. Lewis, Solzhenitsyn, Faulkner, and the Book of Isaiah, along with the Magna Carta. The first version of the speech, written and recommended by the State Department, did not capture President Reagan's objectives or his aesthetic. For grins, he asked a few of his trusted advisors for their opinion of this early drafts, and it was described by one critic as reminiscent of the axiom that a camel is a horse designed by a committee. Because of the State Department, everyone has interests and no one has ideas. After the State Department version, our 40th president asked for Tony Dolan's draft, a speechwriter who had read, understood, and embraced everything written or spoken by Ronald Reagan since 1952. Using virtually nothing from the State Department version, Dolan spent about 2 months working on a new speech in order to create something representing the heart and soul of Ronald Reagan. Despite the fact that the president had been advised by a trusted critic to delete the announcement of the initiative and dismissed it as a dubious idea, the president proceeded with his campaign, headlined by the New York Times, as President Reagan urges global crusade for democracy. The president himself inserted the word crusade into the text and was thrilled the New York Times took his bait. Here are words we'll never forget from that speech.
What I'm describing now is a plan and a hope for the long term. The march of freedom and democracy, which will leave Marxism-Leninism on the ash heap of history as it has left other tyrannies, which stifle the freedom and muzzle the self-expression of the people. And that's why we must continue our efforts to strengthen NATO, even as we move forward with our zero-option initiative in the negotiations on intermediate-range forces, and our proposal for a one-third reduction in strategic ballistic missile warheads. Our military strength is a prerequisite to peace, but let it be clear, we maintain this strength in the hope it will never be used. For the ultimate determinant in the struggle that's now going on in the world will not be bombs and rockets, but a test of wills and ideas, a trial of spiritual resolve. The values we hold, the beliefs we cherish, the ideals to which we are dedicated.
About 50% of Dolan's draft survived the critical pen of Ronald Reagan, who, according to Tony, made it his own. The phrase that freedom and democracy will leave Marxist-Leninism on the ash heap of history was intentionally selected by Dolan, deleted by a few overly sensitive critics, and then reinserted by the president. But did you know that that phrase was coined by Leon Trotsky? When he declared to the Mensheviks, who succumbed to the Bolsheviks, he said, "Our role is played out. Go where you belong from now on into the ash heap of history." After the speech, Margaret Thatcher praised the president for putting freedom on the offensive where it belongs. 3 weeks after his speech in London, Reagan convened a cabinet-level meeting to discuss precisely how Project Democracy would be carried out. Collectively, they believed that it was not reasonable for the United States alone to seek to contain the advance of Soviet troops or to assume all the burdens of fighting Soviet advances. They agreed that no one asks or wants America to fight for their own freedom. What President Reagan said in 1982, which became the treatise for the Reagan Doctrine, was, "We will help you do it." The cabinet deliberated on how the ideas of freedom could be spread to the people of Eastern Europe and how dissident groups behind the Iron Curtain could be supported most successfully. The USIA, the United States Information Agency, took over management of the project, while a democracy program at Georgetown University called for the creation of a National Endowment for Democracy, which would provide money to overseas organizations working to develop democracy in their respective countries. From the president, it received immediate support, and he pushed hard to get funding on Capitol Hill, and a bipartisan coalition got behind the idea. It has been documented that the NED, or the National Endowment for Democracy, proved to be an important tool in the effort to undermine Soviet power. Finally, in 1982, the president closed with,
"Well, the emergency is upon us. Let us be shy no longer. Let us go to our strength. Let us offer hope. Let us tell the world that a new age is not only possible, but probable. During the dark days of the Second World War, when this island was incandescent with courage, Winston Churchill exclaimed about Britain's adversaries, "What kind of a people do they think we are?" Well, Britain's adversaries found out what extraordinary people the British are. But all the democracies paid a terrible price for allowing the dictators to underestimate us. We dare not make that mistake again. So let us ask ourselves, what kind of people do we think we are? And let us answer, free people, worthy of freedom, and determined not only to remain so, but to help others gain their freedom as well.
Thank you for listening.
For more information on the Ronald Reagan Presidential Foundation and Institute, including information on how to become a member, information on upcoming exhibits at the Reagan Library, and more information on the legacy of President Reagan, please visit ReaganFoundation.org. And don't forget to like and follow the Reagan Foundation on all social media platforms.
Don't forget to subscribe to the Words to Live By podcast in your iTunes or Google Play stores and on other podcast platforms as they become available. New episodes of Words to Live By come out every Tuesday. Like what you hear? Check out our A Reagan Forum podcast featuring great speeches delivered at the Reagan Library. New episodes drop every Thursday. And don't forget to follow at Ronald Reagan on Facebook, at Ronald Reagan 40 on Twitter, and Reagan Foundation on YouTube. Also, search for us on SoundCloud and Stitcher.